such, we can say, as you said, tribal, again, tribal, mm-hmm. we could say supremacy started in spreading Islam out of the borders of Arab Peninsula.
So before going to that period, I mean, after the post-Prophet era, because you refer to some of the wars at the time of Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, there are a couple of points to be mentioned here. Of course, in some cases, we have conflict, we have a fight between the Prophet and his enemies. But the point is that, as Muslims, we believe in two types of jihad, initiative jihad and defensive one. And yes. we believe that, according to many scholars, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family had all the right to have both. For defensive war, it is crystal clear. But for initiative war, we have verses of the Quran in this regard as well. But now the question is that, although the Holy Prophet had all the right to have initiative war, to begin a war, but did it happen at all or not?
Yes.
Because according to many scholars, all the prophetic wars, all the wars which happened at the time of the Prophet were defensive. And I believe that this is, the true understanding of the history. First of all, let me also refer to another point. Unfortunately, the Muslim historians, when they want to count the wars of the Prophet, they somehow go to extreme. They exaggerate about the number of the Prophet's war. We know that we have two types of wars, Ghazwas and Sariyas.
Yes.
Ghazwa refers to a war in which the Holy Prophet took part in person, and the Sariya is the one that the Holy Prophet is absent. He sends some people.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. Now, the point is that in many cases, no conflict happens at all. Imagine, the Battle of Tabuk, for example. The Muslim army, they go to a place, and the army is not present at all. In today's terminology, it is not called a war. I mean, no conflict happened at all, but this is considered as one of the big ghazwas of the Prophet. Or for
is this inside the Arab Peninsula, isn't it?
Yeah.
So now when we are talking about the victory of Islam over other lands,
mm-hmm.
is this true again?
I will come to that.
Yes.
But now the point is that because you refer to the time of the Prophet, I need to explain that when it comes to the number, because the people say that, the Holy Prophet had 70 wars, 80 wars, mm-hmm. and it is only during 10 years in Medina, which means that each year about 8 wars, which means that every 2 months, for example, one war, so Islam is the religion of violence, but this is not true. The number of the wars, the ghazwas and sariyas, are not true based on today's standards and criteria. So, for example, the Holy Prophet sends two person in the Sariya, only two person,
yes.
two people, to a region. And first of all, in today's terminology, is it called a war if you send two people to fight another two people or a group of people? It's not a war. In many cases, especially in Sariyas, no conflict happens at all. The Holy Prophet sends some people.
Okay.
But they come to a kind of peace or reconciliation,
yes.
or the enemy is not present. My point is that when it comes to the number of the prophetic wars, we shouldn't exaggerate about
yes.
the number. We should, when it comes to today's terminology
yes.
and the standards, maybe we can conclude that the Holy Prophet had only three wars.
Mm-hmm.
A war with the polities,
yes.
a war with Jews, and another, the third type, with the Christians.
Okay.
And in all these cases, And in none of them, the Holy Prophet began the war.
Yes.
The war with the polytheists began from the Battle of Badr, and we know that they were the one who initiated the war.
Okay.
For the Jews, it was the Jews who broke their peace treaty with the Prophet, and then the Holy Prophet was forced to have a conflict in the case of Bani Qurayza. And of course, for example, Bani Qaynuqa, no real fight happened, but again, it is considered as one of the worst. And the same is true about Christians.
Okay.
So my point is that when it comes to the time of the Prophet, first of all, according to this understanding and based on today's criteria, he had only three wars.
Mm-hmm.
And in all these cases, the enemy began the war and the Holy Prophet only defended himself.
And we should not forget about the main goal that was set by Prophet Muhammad. Was it really... we can say invitation to the religion of Islam and introducing something new to the world in order to reform a society, or no, in order to change the lifestyle of the people, act as if the Romans and the, we can say, Greeks were living, and also spreading Islam through, as you said, fighting a battlefield in order to reach more wealth. You know, these are different goals.
And that's the point we can get from the time the Holy Prophet began sending letters to different rulers and kings of his time. At that time, the Holy Prophet had the utmost power in the region. So while he's sending letters, so he was absolutely able to just, have a kind of fight against all these countries and
defeat
them.
Nothing happens when, for example, the king of Iran, for example, tears apart the letters of Prophet Muhammad, not accepting the invitation, no war took place.
Yeah, the Holy Prophet was able, to initiate a war again. And this is, I believe, rooted in the Noble Book of Quran.
Yes.
The verses of the Quran say that religion is a matter of faith and heart. You cannot force the people to believe in your religion.
So how this path was deviated, Sheikh, after the demise of Prophet?
Yeah, but let me just share one or two verses and then I will come to that. So, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, وَلَوْ شَاءَ رَبُّكَ لَآمَنَ مَنْ فِي الْأَرْضِ كُلُّهُمْ جَمِيعًا. Had your Lord wished, all those who are on earth would have believed. أَفَأَنْتَ تُكْرِهُ النَّاسِ حَتَّى يَكُونُوا مُؤْمِنِينَ. Would you then force people until they become faithful? Very, very explicitly, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that you cannot force the people into the religion of Islam. And the very famous verse, chapter Baqarah 256, لَا إِكْرَاهَ فِي الدِّينِ. There is no compulsion in religion. And of course, when it comes to, for example, the rights of dhimmis, those people of the book who had, kind of covenant with the Islamic government, the Holy Prophet mentioned that the one who bothers a dhimmi, it is as if he or she has bothered me. And many other instructions by the Prophet about good treatment regarding the dhimmis. Now, when it comes to what you mentioned, from the time after the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. As Shia, we believe that what was done by the first three caliphs is not in line with the Islamic teachings. So, and even I would like to go to another step.
Yes.
According to many Shia researchers, if these three caliphs did not attack some countries, maybe today we have more Muslims living on the earth. And maybe those wars, they were against the spread of Islam. Of course, I will come to this point that there are exaggeration and misunderstanding about these wars. So when it comes to the Arab attack to Persia at that time, we know that in most of the regions, Iranians, they welcome the, or the people of Persia, they welcome the Muslim army.
Mm-hmm.
So there are exaggerations about the number of the people who are killed, which is not true, and so on and so forth.
Even in Qadisiyah attack?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay,
in some cases, a number of Iranians were killed.
Yes.
And the people from Persia and the army from Persia. But there are unfortunately many exaggerations about that.
But all in all, do you accept that the method of spreading Islam after the demise of Prophet Muhammad at the time of the caliphs and the Umayyads was very much different from that of Prophet Muhammad, isn't it?
Sure.
Okay.
And as Shia, we are against that. Mm-hmm. We do not,
But still you believe that there are so many exaggerations, for example.
That's another story.
The Orient, okay.
Yeah, the number of the people who are killed, I mean, how the wars were conducted by Muslims. Okay. We have...
Let's discuss them, inshallah, in our upcoming session of the program, because
and
we are
just... one last point, and then we'll... continue the following session. As Shia, we believe that, as I mentioned, without these wars, maybe Islam could have been spread more.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the acts done by the caliphs, there are many examples for this. I will share in the following session. And the last point is that when Imam Ali alayhi salam is selected by the people to be the fourth caliph, of course, he's the true, the first successor of the Prophet, he stops attacking any country, and this is very meaningful for us as not only Shia, rather as the Muslims.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi. We will continue, inshallah, discussion on how the religion of Islam was spread after the demise of Prophet Muhammad, whether we can call it a real victory or colonization of other lands. It was very kind of you.
Please.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islam and Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, call of Islam page, and Allah so God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Another scene of wide-scale destruction in Syria, this time signed by Israel. Israeli fighter jets attacked multiple residential targets in Damascus, killing at least five people and injuring 15 others, with the majority being civilians.
All residents were sleeping in the building. This is a residential neighborhood. The missile landed here. A number of residents were killed and others injured. There are no officials or any prominent figures living here, only ordinary civilians. All apartments were heavily affected.
At 12:15 a.m., we heard loud noises. I asked my mother to step back from the windows. Suddenly, the house shook and we felt an explosion. All windows broke. We asked for help. This is a tragic reality.
The aggression caused significant damage to private property in the heavily populated Kafr Susa quarter in Damascus. Apartments, balconies, and walls collapsed, and nearby cars were affected. Syria's ancient citadel in Old Damascus was also hit. Analysts say Israel's intention for these attacks is to keep Syria in a state of instability.
For 10 years, Israel has been adopting the strategy of strategic battles between wars. The aim is to eliminate any chance of a war on Israel through weakening the enemy. Israel wants Syria to stay in a state of war and instability. This aggression in particular comes as more countries are planning to restore relations with Syria, something Israel wants to foil.
Syria's foreign ministry sent a letter to the UN saying the strikes are part of Israel's systematic aggression against civilians, urging punishment for the crimes committed by the regime. The ministry called for necessary measures to end such aggressions, as well as a clear condemnation from the United Nations Security Council. One shock after another. This is how Syrians live every day, not knowing whether they'll be waking up to an earthquake, act of aggression, or a terrorist attack. All they ask is for the international community to wake up and help ease their unprecedented plights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The Rome-based Islamic Center Imam Mahdi has recently published a book on the late Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qassem Soleimani. Titled A God's Fighter, the Italian language book revolves around General Soleimani's endeavors to defend the oppressed people. A man, quote, driven by an unshakable faith in God. The book is a collection of messages, thoughts, and letters by General Soleimani, a project that has been supported by all the members of the Imam Mahdi Center.
Who did General Soleimani fight for? By publishing this book, we wanted to shed a light on a man who was always described as an anti-something. Yes, he was against Zionism, he fought against Daesh, but he did all that for God, and that's why we call him a God's fighter in our book. This project intends to fill a void in Italy, as for far too long, all accounts on General Soleimani have distorted his true image.
In 2020, 40 days after U.S. assassination of Major General Qassem Soleimani, hundreds of his posters were hung across many Italian cities. Initiatives to honor the slain Iranian military officer were held in Rome and Milan.
Imam Mahdi Center's book on Soleimani also contains speeches by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani on General Soleimani's martyrdom. The publication also contains photos portraying Iran's former top military commander.
Finding good quality photos of Soleimani was a daunting task. There are only a few good shots of him around. He was not a poser. He was a humble man and he didn't love to be in the spotlight. My favorite photos are the ones depicting General Soleimani with kids and also his mother.
General Qassem Soleimani, similar to my father, because he caused that I love Islam more and more. He is my hero because he always helped the weak country or a weak Islamic country. I'm proud of him.
The book closes with 20 short stories on the life of General Soleimani, his relationship with his family, and with the late Iraqi anti-terror commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Max Civili, Rome.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of beds and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society with poor
lower and middle class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thursday, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah warned the United States and its allies that its attempts to stir chaos in the country will not be fruitful.
I'll tell the U.S., if you create chaos in Lebanon, then you will witness chaos in the entire region. If you target our people with your conspiracies, then we will use our power and arms to make you feel pain, even if this means war against your beloved Israel.
The leader of the resistance group also said that the 2019 protests in Lebanon were merely part of a U.S. ploy, which took advantage of weaknesses in the country as part of a new strategy after the failure of direct military invasions.
Lebanon has, from the year 2019, been the target of a new U.S. plot. First, it's a plot to eradicate the achievements and the victories of the resistance and its martyrs. And second, it's a plot to take Lebanon back to being under the hegemony of the U.S., which wants to impose its conditions on the country's domestic affairs and its conditions on relations with the enemy.
Nasrallah, who addressed people during the memorial ceremony of three of Hezbollah's martyred leaders, also emphasized that supporters of the resistance group who are suffering from economic crisis will continue to support the group. Observers believe that all stalemates in Lebanon, whether the inability to elect a president or lack of economic reforms, are all the result of a wave of subtle interference by the U.S.
The U.S. is pressurizing Lebanon economically to impose its conditions and bring to power a president who is loyal to Washington and is not friendly with the resistance, so that it can implement its policies by means of soft power. Having said that, it would not seem that the U.S. has launched a war on Lebanon or the resistance. While it would seem this is an internal Lebanese affair, this is where the threat lies in their plots.
Nasrallah also touched upon the issue of offshore oil and gas exploration, saying Hezbollah will hinder Israel's production of gas from oil fields should procrastination by the companies who have contracts with Lebanon continue.
After assassination of any prominent leader of Hezbollah, the resistance would go through a landmark transformation. Now, in light of what analysts see as a massive U.S. attempt to choke Lebanon politically and economically, the resistance progress is unhindered. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands. Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Heads of NGOs in Syria have gathered to loudly voice an urgent need for help. In Damascus, more than 550 NGOs read out a statement before media outlets calling on the U.S. to lift its unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, explaining the years-long siege deprived Syria from its basic needs and equipment needed to rescue those affected by the deadly earthquake.
Today, I apologize to the victims who we heard their voices under the rubble but could not help. Our volunteers were hearing them but couldn't save them because we do not have necessary equipment. 12 years of sanctions left us without required vehicles and rescue equipment. Many people died under the rubble because of those sanctions.
Speakers say the recent ease of U.S. sanctions on Syria to help humanitarian aid reach the country is not effective. That's because banks, companies, and governments around the world are still reluctant to engage with Syria, as they might face legal obstacles in the future. Western states claim that food and medicine is not included in their list of sanctions, but the reality is vastly different.
Sanctions have affected my life, my neighbors, and all Syrian people. We don't have fuel or electricity, and this has raised prices of everything like food and medicine. This is unbearable, especially after the earthquake.
We all here came to say lift economic sanctions. This country cannot stand any more suffering. Even before the earthquake, we were collapsing economically. Those sanctions are only affecting the ordinary people, not the government.
Here, rescue workers are in a battle against time. The death toll keeps rising, and those who could get away from the earthquake are now struggling to survive with a lack of food and shelter. Syrians say it's about time the U.S. and its Western allies end the economic siege that has caused enormous pain and suffering for innocent citizens. They ask for a just and fair world where humanity comes first before all political agendas. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
We're used to the revolving door of Westminster politics with prime ministers coming and going at dizzying speed. North of the border, things have been much more stable for many years, until this week.
In my head and in my heart, I know that time is now, that it is right for me, for my party, and for the country. And so today I am announcing my intention to step down as First Minister and leader of my party.
Speculation is rife about why she quit, such as the impact of the pandemic and the UK's top court ruling last year against Scottish government's ability to hold a second independent referendum without approval from the British Parliament. But there's one reason that stands out the most.
Her undoing was brought about by the very controversial GRR bill, which would have given people the ability to change their gender after 3 months without a medical certificate. This outraged many feminist groups in Scotland, and it was passed with a big majority in the Scottish Parliament, but was immediately blocked by the Westminster Parliament.
Sturgeon's resignation has also raised the important question of what will happen to Scotland's independence aspirations in her absence from frontline politics, After all, she was the architect of the referendum in 2014 and has pushed for a second one since the first didn't get a majority vote.
The majority of Scots do want independence. This stepping down of the First Minister will be seen as a setback, but it's not a major setback.
With that in mind, a lot will depend on who emerges as the leader of Sturgeon's Scottish Nationalist Party. Some of the names who might throw their hats in the ring: John Swinney, Deputy First Minister; Hamza Youssef, Scottish Cabinet Secretary for Healthcare and Social Care; Kate Forbes, Cabinet Secretary for Finance and Economy; and Angus Robertson, Cabinet Secretary for the Constitution, External Affairs and Culture.
Successive Conservative governments here in London have said that the 2014 referendum was a once-in-a-generation decision and that it cannot be repeated anytime soon. In response, Nicola Sturgeon said she would turn the next Scottish elections into a de facto referendum to ramp up pressure on London to grant another vote. But without her in the driver's seat, it'll now be up to her successor to deliver what she promised. Saeed Purizep, London.
This is all they have to survive with for now. A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. This Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble. This woman says her son has been held in a detention center for months despite having a UN refugee card. With eyes full of tears and a numb voice, she revealed her ordeal.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands. Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman, the outskirts of New Delhi.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
According to a new poll published recently, a growing number of Russian consumers are turning to domestic manufacturers to replace foreign products after the exit of Western companies. Experts say Western sanctions against Moscow, instead of damaging the country's economy, have spurred development in Russian domestic industries. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RIA Novosti, citing a poll by Nielsen IQ research company, nearly half of Russians have successfully found domestic substitutes for foreign products made unavailable due to sanctions. According to the findings, over the past year, 47% of Russians have completely switched to locally produced brands or began to buy products of local production more often. About a third of respondents did not change their preferences and continued to buy the same brands they used too before 2022, and 17% switched to new brands, but also of foreign production. Respondents offered several reasons for turning to local brands. Over half of them said they did it to support domestic producers, while 20% pointed to an inability to find foreign analogs at a reasonable price. Another 10% stated that they could not find foreign goods that match the quality and characteristics they value, but see them in Russian products. Also, according to RT, after the start of Moscow's military operation in Ukraine, many major Western brands announced their withdrawal from the Russian market and the suspension of investments and imports. According to economists from Switzerland's University of St. Gallen, more than 1,400 companies have decided to quit Russia over the past year, including electronics manufacturers, retailers, automakers, clothing and food brands, hotels, banks, and restaurant chains. Yet, despite concerns that the trend would damage the Russian economy, it has spurred the development in domestic industries. Analysts say the current situation presents a good opportunity for growth for Russian producers. Earlier this month, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the departure of Western brands has meant our domestic manufacturers received unique opportunities for development, and we must take advantage of them. Putin added that the country's producers have been given a chance to occupy niches which until recently were closed to them due to competition from global players. Industry experts warn that the only concern now is whether domestic manufacturers are ready to meet increased demand and urge companies to invest in expanding their production capabilities. Alexey Popovichev, head of the Rus Brand Association of Manufacturers, told RIA Novosti, if production facilities cannot meet the growing demand, it is necessary to invest in development. Saving money may lead to a desire to simplify the process, and this is fraught with a loss of quality. Meanwhile, Modern Diplomacy wrote, de-dollarization emerged as a priority for Russia in 2014 in response to the imposition of Western sanctions. following the annexation of Crimea that limited the ability of state firms and banks to raise financing in Western markets. China also began seeing value in this initiative after the onset of the U.S.-China trade war in 2018 and the use of punitive financial measures by the U.S. regime, wrote authors of a report, Russia and China, Partners in De-Dollarization at the Atlantic Council. Moscow found an early partner in Beijing to support its de-dollarization effort as part of their expanding economic cooperation. Chinese premier signed 38 agreements on a visit to Moscow in 2014, deepening cooperation on energy and establishing a three-year currency swap deal worth 150 billion yuan, about $24.5 billion. This deal was renewed for another 3 years in 2017. Russia and China shifted further away from using the dollar in bilateral trade in 2018, following the U.S. imposition of heavy tariffs on Chinese goods and the onset of the U.S.-China trade war. While Moscow had previously spearheaded the de-dollarization initiative, Beijing quickly modeled Russia's strategy when it perceived its own risk to punitive U.S. financial measures. This made way for a 2019 agreement to replace the dollar with national currencies in international settlements between them. Modern diplomacy added such financial coordination helped Russia reduce its reliance on the greenback in trade. While 80% of Russia's total exports were denominated in U.S. dollars in 2013, only a little over half of its total exports today are settled in dollars. Most of the decrease was absorbed by its trade with China. Apart from de-dollarization of bilateral trade with China, Russia has begun replacing its dollar reserves with yuans and euros. Between 2013 and 2020, the Russian Central Bank halved its dollar-denominated reserves. In 2021, it revealed plans to completely ditch all dollar assets from its sovereign wealth fund and increase holdings in yuan and gold instead, thus acquiring a quarter of the world's yuan reserves.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam, my Deen. Allah, my Lord. His word, Quran. Muhammad, Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Youth Station.
Yes, I send you my warmest greetings from this snowy studio.
Which reminds me that I'm not alone.
Of course.
Welcome to the studio, sister.
Yes, I am Asma.
How have you been?
Very much happy to be here once more. It's good.
Are you actually happy you're staying outside there?
Yeah.
You're indoors right now.
Yeah, I'm beyond happy.
Would you not rather be outside?
Of course, yes. I'd rather.
Right, but then when you're outside, would you still have the same pleasure that you wanted when you were going to go outside?
Of course. There's a difference, but here is good as well.
You want to go outside.
Yes.
You're waiting to go outside. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it's snowing outside,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Once you get there,
yeah,
are you still going to have that level of anticipation that you have? Or is it going to be like, okay, now that I'm outside, what's the point?
You want me to say no, then I wouldn't say that because it's still yes.
Right, what's more exciting, looking at the snow or waiting to go outside?
Looking at the snow, I guess.
Right, so once you're there, that's mm-hmm. going to be. So yeah. Is that how you are in your life?
Well, it's different now. Now the story is different totally.
Do you wait for things, or do you like in life getting somewhere? Is that more exciting for you, or the journey towards that place is more exciting?
In life, everything is different. In life, when I dream for something and I have all of those anticipations in my mind, I guess it's more interesting than when you get to reach it, to have it.
Right.
When it becomes a tangible thing, when you no longer wait for it, when it has come true, I guess the happiness is just going to long for some days, let's say. And when you grow older, it's not even days. It's just for some maybe hours. And then everything is just gone. You have to find a new dream. So that means a new aim in life, a new purpose, a new thing to achieve in order
to... Yeah, that means that you've reached a lot of your dreams, because not many people know that it's like that to have a dream and get there. And then it's like, oh, you know, it sobers down a lot. You know, like...
No, on the contrary, you know what I would
like,
say?
People, like, wait lifetimes to get something done. And, like, people might not even achieve that thing that they have in their mind.
If you're a thinker, if you think too much, if you overthink about things that you want to achieve, then the moment you get them, you understand... Even if it's only once, even if it's only one experience, then if you think about it properly, if you are a person who goes beyond the surface of things, then I guess that's enough for you to understand that the destination is not the whole thing. Sometimes the journey itself is more beautiful, I suppose.
Okay.
That's a personal idea. What about you?
For me, I've actually learned it the hard way. Depends on what your destination, what your aim and goal is, right? That's what defines how you're going to feel, both when you're headed that way and once you've been there. Like, how you're going to feel, that's what defines it. So for me, it was an experience like that too. I wanted certain things in life, I wanted to be in certain places in life, and I got there before the time that was about supposed to. Like, it was sooner than expected that I got what I wanted.
Happened?
And then, yeah, that was this hollowness in there for me. For me, at least, you know, everyone's different.
People are different.
Yeah, you know, some could be overwhelmed by what they gain. And some people could be disappointed. For me, it was like, oh, yeah.
Is that all?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's something that happened to me. So for me, I don't think it's about the journey, nor how I feel before or after. For me, it's what is it that I'm going after, you know? Mm-hmm. So if that whatever that I'm headed towards is something that's not defined by boundaries, and my joy at after achieving that whatever that thing is, the goal or aim that I have is, it is also not going to have boundaries. But that thing itself, whatever that I want, if that is bound by certain boundaries or, you know, whatever limitations, then
it would be all the worldly things.
Yeah, it would be. And your joy, your pleasure out of the achievement is also going to be quite limited.
Yeah.
Right? As you said, hours or days. Yeah, that's what I think. How do you think that countries define their aims and goals?
Well, let's go for a short break and then we'll think about it.
And we'll think on the break, during the break.
Yeah.
And then come back, talk about it.
Of course.
Yeah, let's go.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So welcome back. This is Youth Station, and we're talking about to have a aim or not to have.
To have
to
or not
go
to
for
have.
A destination or
the
just the journey. Which one?
Right.
And then you asked me a question, and then you said how countries define.
You have a aim. Someone has a aim, a goal, whatever, a dream. And then their countries, their entire countries, they have goals, right? For example, the U.S., you might say the goal is oil.
So whatever the goal of the country is. Is it going to have an effect on my personal goal?
No, like people form a society in a country, right? So a country has a goal now.
Yeah.
We've moved on from individual goals. You described your feelings and I described mine. And I'm talking about a country. like a massive society, which is a country, right?
Yeah.
Has goals, right? And
of
it
course.
Goes towards those goals.
Mm-hmm.
What defines those goals? And what about what is that entire group of people, which is, again, a country?
Yeah, I guess I get what you want to say. Well, you mean, what about the countries? Now we talked about individual goals. Mm,
yeah.
What about when the countries achieve their goals?
Yeah, they have a goal. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What defines...
So, like, just like the revolutions in the history of the world.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
happens to
or
the
history... Revolutions or aggressive wars.
Yeah,
you know,
wars,
like,
yes.
You know, anything that a country is as a whole.
So again, I would tell you that, this is my personal point of view, I would say. After a certain time, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know, they also would get accustomed to what they have. And they no longer understand the value of what they have achieved. And then maybe they're going to take it for granted. And then maybe they're going to ask for more of changes into the worst or into the best.
Right. That,
don't you think so?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That too. I hadn't looked at it from that perspective. The thing I had in my mind was they also realize that they've done wrong, like entire countries. For example, US. Now, I don't want to like, repeat US, but it's a good example. US moved into Iraq, right?
Yeah.
And then they came out and they were like, well, there was no chemical weapons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that
yeah.
was. And a lot of people in the Congress now, or the people, the society, the individuals in that country now are criticizing that, you know, that move that they made.
Yeah.
That as a country that they'd done, mm-hmm. they'd made, and the fact that they were proven wrong, you know, because
yes.
like, yeah, as a whole, you had certain goals in your mind.
Of course.
Right? So if your society, if your people, your lawmakers, your policymakers, your government is made of individuals who've got a very materialistic approach to life or, you know, goals in general,
yeah, yeah.
then your country is going to head towards that. After all, even when they achieve whatever it was, it's still going to be like that little teenager. Like, an entire country is going to be like that teenager who was obsessed with something, headed towards it rushingly, like he hastily.
And then they got it.
And then I'm like, oh, no. Either it was a mistake or what? Oh, no. Okay, now what? You know that. So you
so what?
As a whole.
Yes.
Yeah, so what? Exactly. So you as a whole, as a country, are going to look like a teenager. Like, sorry mm-hmm. for my
Then what about
example.
Me? Like, it, just an individual.
Who is within the country.
Yeah.
For example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. On the other hand, you as a nation, as you mentioned, that's something very clever that you point towards. As a nation, you might achieve something.
Yeah.
Right? And then, like, you get accustomed and you get used to it and you take it for granted.
Exactly.
And then you might, like, walk backwards. Right, you're walking backwards yeah. now.
Just like what happens to us, as in every step of life. Every single time we have a dream, we achieve it, then I say, okay, so what was it? All the efforts I've been through was for this? So
yeah.
now then what? If I don't have a new dream, if I did not create a new aim for myself, a new prospect of the future, then I won't be able to move on in a very much purposeful direction.
Mm. Well, that means that while you're aiming for certain things, you've got to plan. You've got to plan, okay, what's next?
Yeah.
You know, like you have to go through.
You know what's next?
What's next?
Another break. Back, this is after what's next.
Right, so what's next? Right,
yeah.
For an individual, we talked about for an individual. So you want to go somewhere, you want to achieve something, but then, yeah, if you've not planned out, if you've not thought about what's next, what you're going to do after whatever you
yeah.
want, and then that's that feeling of
emptiness,
yeah, hollowness,
ambiguity,
yeah. Yeah, so you've lost.
You know, that's what happened after World War II. And then a lot of schools of thought appeared after that. And then they were talking about the emptiness of life. Like Albert Camus, when he talked about the literature of absurd.
Right.
And then he was talking about the absurdity of life. I guess that's what happened to...
Was he talking about himself or like the society in general?
No, he was talking about individuals and also society as well. So he was talking about the absurdity of life, and I guess it's pretty much relatable. After a certain time when you are going through too much, and then it's finished, and then you come to say, okay, and then what? And then life starts to seem as so absurd and sometimes even empty. And all the things that you've been through, it seems like a futile effort for nothing. So I guess what matters more is just to have a thing in your mind, just to have a personal aim, as in being a good person. That's the only aim, I guess, you would never get accustomed to, or it's nothing that is going to end. Because the more you try for being a good human being, a good obedient to Allah, then the more you are going to learn.
Okay, so yeah, the latter is something that you can talk about, like being obedient to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Your goal, for example, being a good person, obedient to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. What if your goal is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? If your goal is Him, then like the more you get closer to Him, then the more you gain, right? And the more you feel
And the
excited.
More you try to be better, to get closer, and to feel it more and more.
You won't have that emptiness anymore.
Exactly.
Right? So that's not going to be... So if a society itself, the entire country, society, is formed up by individuals with this perspective or this, outlook on life, then, that society, that country is going to move towards
something
divine.
And then,
divine.
At the very beginning part of this discussion today, you mentioned something very nice. Everything that has got a border is going to bore you out, is going to make you tired of all the efforts that you have done for achieving the thing that you wanted to achieve. But when you pin your hopes, your expectations on something that is beyond borders, like what I said, like being a good obedient to Allah, like as you said, getting closer to Allah Himself, then there is no end to that. So even in the aims and purpose that we are creating in our brain, I guess we must be metaphysical. We should go beyond the physics, beyond the tangible world.
You know what has a limit? What?
This world, of course, has
this program, this episode.
that's also
something that has a limit. Yeah, so I think we've hit the limit right now.
Just before we ended this limit, I would say that. Now, to have a name, it's very good, because without dreams, we're not...
To have a name, okay.
Yeah. Mm. Without dreams, we're not going to continue our life, because then life is going to turn into a boring thing. It's very good to have a dream, but I guess the better thing is to be a better person than what you are today and right now. It's the best thing, the best dream that a person could have is to improve themselves on a daily basis.
Compare yourself to your yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. And then I would say, there is this poem that I love so much. It's by Emily Dickinson, and she says, "If I can stop one heart from breaking, I shall not live in vain."
Wow.
"If I can ease one life, the aching, I shall not live in vain. And if I can help a fainting robin into his nest, I shall not live in vain." So it's not all about the physical things, how much money you have gained, how many, or whatever physical. It's all about the heart that you have, and that's all.
Yeah, okay, let's hit for the station, the stop. We're going to move our train further in our next episodes. Until then,
may Allah protect you.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.